this theme of communion, I tried to share a little bit of my story and journey as I came into faith and a practice of faith in the Catholic Church, the Roman Catholic Church, in a little logging town in Northern California, where I was started my journey there, began the practice of communion, which allowed me to feel part of that community in an official way, kind of. I learned to confess my sins. I learned to think about God in different ways. And that continued there. And then I moved, our family moved again back to another small town. And I did start attending another Catholic church there. But that at that time, I was 12, 13. And Dad never was part of this worship. So for whatever reasons, I faded out of church life altogether. And by the time I'm in my older teens or middle teens, I'm starting to develop habits and doing things that really aren't good. And in this awareness of God, I really didn't want it. And I remember seeing a book in those days about evolution and thinking, yes, you know, this is it, and there's no God. And in the 60s, this is when I'm growing, God is dead, right? That's the theme, a big theme of the 60s. God is dead, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and, you know, whatever. It was just a lot of change going on. So I remember thinking, you know, that, wow, this is better that God's not involved, because I had all that Catholic teaching, you know, and I didn't want to think about being accountable anymore to God, that whatever that was. What I wanted to talk about today, I wanted to read from Romans first. Romans chapter 1, and I gave you that, Tanner, starting in verse 18. The wrath of God, okay? Now that is not something we like to talk about, is it? What is that? Is that like the wrath of Kath? You guys don't even know what that's about. But I do. And that you know what the wrath of Kath's usually about?
That was a start.
The wrath of Kath is usually about me messing up pretty big time. Now, the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven. I'm going to stop right there because I want us to think about the wrath of God gets a bad rap, I think. As I study this, what is the wrath of God? Because we think about this person now that's irritated and mad, and they're going to get you, right? But that's not what it is. It's not what the wrath of God is. The wrath of God, and it'll be explained as we go through this scripture a little more, is when we decide to selfishly live and sin, basically. We do the wrong stuff. And when we do the wrong stuff in a universe that was created by God and his laws of love hold everything together, consequences come, don't they? There are consequences for selfishness. We may not think so in the moment as we're taking things for ourselves, but it will catch up to you. And in your conscience or in your even your life, things will go wrong. This is what the wrath of God is. It's really what man brings on himself. It's not God going, bam, I'm going to get you. No, it's man bringing stuff on himself. So this is what it says here. The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness. Lying, cheating, you know, that stuff, not good, is it? Since what may be known about God is plain, maybe I skip some, suppress the truth by their wickedness. Since what may be known about God is plain to them, because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power, divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. So what that says to me in Romans there is this created world or universe speaks of God. It's to everyone, all the time, right? All the time. And even if we didn't know anything about any religion and we're walking amongst the creation, we would have this sense of God through the creation. That's what I believe this is saying here in Romans. And I bring that out today because also, so when I last week I talked about when I was 6 or 7, coming into this idea of Catholicism and communion and mass and community, religious life, what also was happening to me in a big way was I was becoming very aware of the creation. And it was speaking to me constantly. I was coming into a communion with the creation. And we all do this. Steve talks about being from Kansas, and he, you know, misses tornadoes or whatever he does over there. You know, I mean, that's I'm sure Amy thinks about Montana maybe in broad horizons. Greg Sheasley maybe thinks about New Jersey. I don't know if he does. But we all have this connection with creation. Craig Bozzi thinks about the waves in Santa Barbara. I know he does. He's always thinking about that stuff. We're all connected to this creation, and it's a powerful communion that we hold with the creator of the universe. And I think it gets played down way too much in Christianity. So our family lived in the heart of the Redwood Forest in Humboldt County. That's where I lived. That's where I moved when I was 6, to a deep part of the Redwood National Forest now today. My house was literally 2 miles from the tallest tree in the world. And I camped under it one day. The sign was there. And with my friend, we camped there, and during that night, in the middle of the night, we heard another giant redwood tree fall, and I thought I was dying, because when a redwood tree falls in the forest, it makes a big sound. But I was in this environment for 6 to 12 years of age, and on one side of our small farm at the end of a gravel road, on one border was the redwood forest. On the other border was Redwood Creek. And I ran free between those and in that area for all those years. And that is deep in me, deep in my spirit. And Kathy could tell you, every time we drive through that little area, I'm like, it just touches me. It touches me. I can't stop it. It happens. I know those trees. I know that stream. I know that place. That was me. I'm moved deeply. These feelings and thoughts come from a communion with Mother Nature. You know, St. Francis talked about Brother Sun and Sister Moon and this communion he had with nature. We need that. We need that. John speaks about the environment today. We are connected. We are part of everything. Nature's been here way before this. God's creation has been way before the Bible was ever written. He's been speaking, like it says in Romans 1, to all mankind through the creation. I want to just to focus on this point. I want to read 2 Wendell Berry poems. Okay? You ready? Poetry time. Here we go. Let's wake up. Listen to this. When we convene again to understand the world, okay? So we've gathered together today to understand the world. The first speaker, okay, it's going to be me, will again point silently out the window at the hillside in its season, sunlit. See that dogwood tree out there? Some of you can. It's like over 100 years old. It'll bloom white here in a few weeks. And we will nod silently and silently stand and go. It speaks to us. Things that we can't even say. Another one. As timely as a river, God's timeless life passes into this world. It passes through bodies, giving life, our bodies even, and past them, giving death. The secret fish leaps up into the light and is again darkened. The sun comes from the dark. It lights the always passing river, shines on the great branch tree, and goes. Longing and dark, we are completely filled with breath of love in us, forever incomplete. I love that, because it speaks about something way beyond us. And now I'm going to read my own poem that I read a few weeks ago, and I was kind of humble, I was bashful, but I'm not so bashful today. Because it had to do with that earlier story I told you about me growing up in the Redwoods. And so I titled it The Ancient Ones. The ancient ones have always been here, piercing the heavens and transforming the earth. As a boy, I danced on their graves. As an elder, I bow before their thrones and cathedrals. When I travel through their native land, I smell and listen to their silence. Walking among them renews the spirit, and patience seeps into my being. So the poem helps me express something, and that's part of who I am. And a few of you I've dragged down there, and you know I get a little crazy when I'm down there, because I sense this presence, this communion with God in nature. So when we think about this idea of communion, Jesus used bread and wine because it was the most common meal people had in those days, in that region, in that time. It's the most common thing he could say here. Be part of me. I want us to turn, or we can put it up on the screen, to Genesis 14, 17 through 24. Okay. You guys aren't going to understand this. I don't understand it. But this is an ancient, ancient story about a character called Melchizedek. You heard of him? Melchizedek? He's mentioned like twice in the Old Testament. And then we're going to turn to Hebrews a little bit today, but I encourage you to study it on your own. And there, the writer of Hebrews, who's trying to explain who Jesus is now to the Jews, talks about Melchizedek a bunch. But in this story, I want you to just see the original story here. So what's happened in this? This is an ancient story. How many thousands of years ago? It's like before there are any Hebrews. Abram is like the person God's calling out, right? To make a people. And what I believe he's doing with Abraham is he's going to eventually reconcile the world. But it's this long, drug-out process. But in this story, in this very beginning stage, Abram has just, the kings that are in the world in those days are warring against each other. Does that sound new? They're warring against each other. And during this war, Lot, Abram's nephew, is taken away captive, and other things and people too. And Abram wants to go rescue him. So after this war has taken place with these kings from different parts, Abram goes out and conquers this people that had already kind of won a war, and gets Lot back and all this stuff. And now he's here. So after Abram returned from defeating Chedorlaomer, I can't say that. Who can say that? He's a bad guy, a really bad guy, bad king. And the kings allied with him, the king of Sodom came out to meet him in the valley of Shaveh. This is the king's valley. Then Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. Whoa. This is like an interesting passage to me. It kind of just goes, what is happening? He was priest of God Most High. And he blessed Abram, saying, "Blessed be Abram by God Most High, creator of heaven and earth. And blessed be God Most High, who delivered your enemies into your hand. Then Abram gave him a tenth of everything. Now, this is way before there's any ideas of law or tithing or anything. And Abram gives this Melchizedek a tenth of everything. Okay. The king of Sodom said to Abram, "Give me the people and keep the goods for yourself." Now, this voice is not a voice that's good. It's a voice of selfishness, okay, in the story. But listen to Abram's response. But Abram said to the king of Sodom, "I have raised my hand to the Lord Most High, creator of heaven and earth, and have taken an oath that I will accept nothing belonging to you, not even a thread or a thong of a sandal, so that you will never be able to say, 'I made Abram rich.' I will accept nothing but what my men have eaten and the share that belongs to the men who went with me to Aner, Ashkel, and Mamre." These are the guys that were with him. "Let them have their share." Okay, we'll stop there. We see a pattern that starts. I just want to show you. This goes way back, this pattern of bread and wine and generosity and hospitality and forgiveness and faithfulness and grace. And it's in this story. And we see it here in this story. So I just wanted to show you that thread that we have there in Genesis, way back in Genesis. Because communion is about sharing in something. It's a unity of spirit. John called it the economy of the kingdom of heaven it represents, which is generosity and forgiveness and hospitality and grace. Who is Melchizedek? Some think he's Jesus making an appearance. Could Jesus do that? Yeah. Is Jesus only born like in Bethlehem? And, you know, was that the only time Jesus, is that when Jesus started? No. He's part of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, the Trinity, have been forever. We'll turn to Hebrews. In the Old Testament, we don't necessarily get that, but the writer of Hebrews tends to drive that home. So in Hebrews 4, I thought I had it marked here in my Bible. I know you guys have it. Here we go. Hebrews 4, it's going to speak of Jesus in verse 14. "Therefore, since we have a great high priest..." Now, we have to understand that all this language and stuff is being spoken to the Jews who are now Christians and trying to understand who Jesus is. They know what priests are. They've had a high priest. They've had high priests all the time who Jesus now has kind of like replaced and superseded. And this writer of Hebrews is trying to get this across to him. "Therefore, since we have a great high priest who has gone through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold firmly to the faith we profess. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but we have one who has been tempted in every way, just as we are, yet was without sin. Let us then approach the throne of grace with confidence so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need." So stop. If you don't get anything else today, get this. This is who Jesus is to you and I. And you can approach him anytime, any place, anywhere, because it's a throne of grace. It's not someone who's ready to stomp you out or whatever. It's not someone that's angry with you. God says, "Come to me." And that's what communion's about. It's what I said last week. We don't surrender at the cross. I really don't think we do. We surrender at this table, this cup, and this bread. The cross chooses us. We don't choose it. And the cross represents suffering. And we all will suffer. It's guaranteed. I mean, Jesus makes it clear with Peter, you know, someday somebody's going to come and take you where you don't want to go. But, you know, and he kind of prophesied over him how he'd die. But we're all in that boat. We're all going to be taken places we don't want to be, in situations we don't want to be. That's the cross. And in that, we can hold strong because of the grace of God, because we surrender at a table. A God who says, come to me, I accept you, I welcome you, and I strengthen you in my love today. Today I want to do that. Communion is about sharing in something greater than ourselves. So in this Hebrews text, I think I said five verse. And he says in another place, so we're in Hebrews. You can read this yourself because I'm just going to skip through it. You are a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. So this comes up again. What kind of priest? A high priest. But he has, this high priest is different than the priests of Aaron, the priesthood of Moses, the priesthood of any kind of priesthood we could think of today, because there's still priesthoods, aren't there? And I'm not saying priesthoods are bad. I'm just saying Jesus is the high priest. He's our priest. He's your priest. He's mine. And there's nothing that stands in the way of that for you or for me. There's no hoop you have to jump through. Okay. During the days of Jesus' life on earth, he offered up prayers and petitions. Now, this is why Jesus is our high priest. With loud cries and tears to the one who could save him from death. And he was heard because of his reverent submission. Although he was a son, he learned obedience from what he suffered. And once made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation for all who obey him, and was designated by God to be high priest in the order of Melchizedek. Okay? I just want to kind of stimulate you with Melchizedek today, the guy who brought bread and wine to Abram in Genesis, in the middle of nowhere, or whatever that, the King's Valley. And Abram gave a tenth of everything to. Hebrews, let's bounce a couple more. Hebrews 7:1, is that what I gave you, Tanner? This Melchizedek was king of Salem and priest of God Most High. He met Abraham returning from the defeat of the kings and blessed him. So this writer of Hebrews is reinforcing this old story. And Abraham gave him a tenth of everything. First, his name means king of righteousness. Then also king of Salem, which means king of peace. Without father or mother, without genealogy, without beginning of days or end of life, like the Son of God, he remains a priest forever. I said to stop there, right? Yeah. One more, and then Hebrews 7:11. Is that what I said? 7:11, maybe I'm off there. 7:11 sounds interesting. Oh, okay. If perfection could have been attained through the Levitical priesthood. Okay, now see again, what the writer's trying to do is get the Jewish people to see that they're used to a system, aren't they? They're used to a religion. Jesus came to set them free from their religion and to make himself known to them as one that could be approached boldly. Because it's a throne of grace, not a place you enter through blood and sacrifice and beating one's chest. It's not about that. Melchizedek was a pattern of Christ coming. Okay. So I'm just going to skim this. So in the order of Melchizedek, he's making an emphasis, not Aaron. And now to us today, that maybe doesn't mean much. To the Jews, that meant a lot, didn't it? It was their whole, the law and prophets hanging on. And then in 8:13, which I read last week, we'll just look at this again. This new covenant that Jesus came speaking about, and we're remembering it through the bread and the wine, this covenant that he makes with us, the new covenant, it's replacing the old. By calling this covenant new, and Jesus calls it the new covenant, he's made the first one obsolete. And what is obsolete and aging will soon disappear. The law, religion, as anyone knew it. Today, you and I are still trying to get free from religion. It tries to corner us. It guilt us, make us feel better than others. It has all kinds of tricks. The ego. And you and I is a tricky dude. And it likes to think it's better than others. or knows more. We're not celebrating ourselves. And religion really is about celebrating yourself. It's about accomplishing something that you do, right? It's got a great temptation to it. What we can do for God in keeping laws, duties, but celebrating the one who accepts and welcomes and makes us new creations by the Spirit in the love of God is Jesus. So I just want to close today with one story from the Gospels, which is probably my favorite story in the Gospels. But I know I say that probably a lot. There's so many good ones. But this one, we've all heard of it. Did I give it to you in Luke? Okay, here we go. It's called The Road to Emmaus, and I know we know this story, but it's a story of communion. It's a story of the risen Christ. And, you know, when Easter Sunday comes, we won't talk a lot. We'll celebrate a lot that day. We'll eat a lot that day. We'll have a little message, but there's so many messages about the risen Christ. And we celebrate the risen Christ really all the time. It's what we're doing here today. We're celebrating this gift of grace and life to us all. But here we have a time when Jesus had just died, had been crucified, things were scattered, things were broken, things were turned upside down. The disciples didn't know what was going on. Jesus had risen from the dead, and who had he revealed himself to at this point? Mary. Mary who? Magdalene. Right? Who is Mary Magdalene? Is she a woman of faith? Is she a woman with a past? Yeah. Well, I don't. She had received the love of Jesus and the forgiveness of Jesus and the new life of Jesus. And she's the one. She's the only one that's maybe seen him at this point. And the other women that went with her, Jesus has revealed himself. In different accounts, Jesus speaks right to her. The angels speak. She's told the disciples, but the disciples... They all saw him die. What would you and I think? We saw all our hopes and dreams gone. But here we are, right after. I don't know if it's a couple days or what. Oh, no, the same day. Two of them were going to a village called Emmaus, about 7 miles from Jerusalem. They were talking with each other about everything that had happened. As they talked and discussed these things with each other, Jesus himself came up and walked along with them, but they were kept from recognizing him. How many times has Jesus come up and walked with you and I, and we don't recognize him? But I love this story. Jesus is with these two, risen. They don't have a clue. They're all caught up in, oh, no, which, you know, I get caught up in that too. He asks them, what are you discussing together as you walk? And they stood still, their faces downcast. One of them, named Cleopas, asked him, are you the only visitor in Jerusalem who doesn't know the things that have happened here in these days? You know, so he's almost like, what? What's that Jesus Christ superstar? What are they talking about? What's the buzz? Tell me what's happened. Everybody's aware of this stuff that happened. I mean, there was darkness and earthquakes and people coming out of the graves maybe. And there was like nobody didn't know. How could you say you don't know what we're talking about? But Jesus could say that, couldn't he? I guess he could just tell a little lie there. He doesn't care. Okay, he lies later. Okay, what things? That's not a lie. He's just playing with them. About Jesus of Nazareth, they replied. He was a prophet, powerful in word and deed before God and all the people. The chief priests and our rulers handed him over to be sentenced to death, and they crucified him. But we had hoped that he was the one who was going to redeem Israel. And what is more, it's the third day since all this took place. In addition, some of our women amazed us. They went to the tomb early this morning, but didn't find his body. They came and told us that they had seen a vision of angels who said he was alive. Then some of our companions went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but him they did not see. Jesus said to them, "How foolish you are." Now here's a stranger talking to him. They're like, huh? "How foolish you are, and how slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Did not the Christ have to suffer these things and then enter his glory? And beginning," now here's what's interesting, "and beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning the law and keeping the rules of the law." What? Himself. That's the whole point in Hebrews. It's not about the old covenant. It's obsolete. It's disappearing. This is life. "So beginning with Moses and the prophets, he explained to them what was said in all scripture concerning himself. As they approached the village to which they were going, Jesus acted as if he was going farther." Again, he's messing with them. Does he want to see if they're going to be his real true disciples and be hospitable? If he did, then they passed the test. "Stay with us, for it's nearing evening, and the day is almost over." So he went in to stay with them. And this is the part I love. "When he was at the table with them, he took the bread, he gave thanks, he broke it, and he began to give it to them. Then their eyes were opened." Isn't that interesting? Why weren't their eyes opened earlier? I don't know. I guess it's just for us to wonder, just like Melchizedek. Was that Jesus? I don't know. Does it matter? No, not really. Did God create the world 4 billion years ago in through evolution? Maybe. Did he do it in a much shorter frame? Maybe. Is it worth us fighting about or arguing about? Not at all, because it's Jesus is what's important and him coming forth to be in our lives today. God's creation, you know, when I was without God in my lost life, creation was speaking to me. Creation was calling me into a communion, even as God, he through Jesus, was too. Because they're the same. They worked. God is one. Jesus, it says in several places in Scripture, that he's the creator of all things. That he created, the whole universe was created through him and by him and for him and to him. And we don't have to intellectualize that and understand that. We feel that deep inside us. We have a communion with our God in nature and through bread and wine and one another. You know, we don't take communion on Easter Sunday because it's not about the symbols. It's about a fellowship with one another. And I said this a few weeks ago, if you have a meal with someone, it's a sacred thing. It's a sacred thing. These are just symbols, but they speak of something way bigger than us and deeper than us and pulling us together. "Then their eyes were open and they recognized him and he disappeared from their sight." Because Jesus is new now. He's in a new body. I guess we get a body like this someday too. It's going to be pretty cool. "They asked each other, were our hearts burning within us while he talked with us on the road and opened the scriptures to us? They got up and returned at once to Jerusalem. There they found the 11 and those with them assembled together and saying, It is true the Lord has risen and has appeared to Simon." So there's been an appearing on both ends here when they come back together. "Then the two told what happened to them on the way and how Jesus was recognized by them when he broke the bread." So part of this story, I think, is for us today to know that when we break bread together, whether it be here or whether it be in our homes or wherever it be, that Jesus, where two or more gathered in his name that he's there in our midst. And it's a powerful promise, and it's something we live in. So today, I pray for myself, and I pray for all of us here, that as we take the bread, as we walk out in creation today, Lord, that we would see you anew, see you like these disciples saw when you broke the bread, and they saw new. Help our seeing be new today in everything.